speaking of that caliber, and I want to get back just for a second to WJMJ, because I think I've just seen somebody that walked in. Am I correct? Is that Glenn Colligan?
No.
No, it isn't. All right. But I do see Norm Hausman, who had his hand up a second ago, and I think Norm wants to say something. Norm and Dick Wisniak, by the way, were co-past presidents of the Central Connecticut State University Alumni Association, so you may hear something about CCSU.
Hi, my name's Norm Hausman. I was never have the privilege of being connected with your business in any way, but I do remember as a boy being fascinated with radio, in particular radio broadcasts coming out of the old Bulkley Stadium in Hartford. And together with some others, we're endeavoring to write a history of the old ballpark, Morgan G. Bulkley Stadium in the South End. And I simply wanted to ask if any of you have memories or artifacts or photos of the stadium or know somebody that does, I'd be more than delighted to hear from you. Thank you.
Now, the stadium he's talking about used to be the home of the old Hartford Chiefs baseball team. That was broadcast on WTHT radio. A fellow named Mitch Betters, another Lake Jensen type with a beautiful, deep voice, would do the play-by-play. And there were a lot of major leaguers who came through Hartford in those days as well. And there was another team that occupied that stadium after the big leagues or the minor leagues left. It was called the Savitt Gems, run by Bill Savitt, of course. And so those were, for all of us old enough, the really good old days.
Hartford
Knights was the football team that played down at the Dillon Stadium, however. Yeah, that didn't play at Buckley. Now, we've gone on a long time, but are there any questions or other comments that anybody wants to make? Steve?
I just got a couple of other people here I want to point out that we haven't gotten around to. Barry Grant, if you'd stand up there for a second. Barry?
Yes.
They're coming up here. Barry had Grant's tomb on WDRC, and was a very, very big part of the rock and roll AOR, what we call album-oriented rock scene.
And we kind of moved forward in time a little bit. Most of the people, except for Walt Pinto and Dave Nagel, these guys were like my parents' age. Everybody's Steve's father was, I think, the most brilliant person in broadcasting. So right here. In this area, you have the genius, not just of Hartford, talking about the entire country. And he was my mentor. Without him, I probably would have never had any success at all in the business. And Steve can probably give us some insight here, because he let me do something that was amazing when we look back on it. That station was what I would consider to be a perfect radio station. I grew up with POP and DRC. I'm from Manchester. And DRC was a precise radio station. The word they used in radio was called tight. It was a tight station. There was no dead air. All the people on the air knew exactly what they were doing and how to do it. And Charlie was the perfect man to motivate people and to keep track of it all. And then all of a sudden he brought me in to do the Midnight to Six show, and he gave me total control, which, again, in retrospect, I had total control of that time period. I chose the music. I made up the contest. I said whatever I wanted to say. He never criticized me. I had the chance to break records, the FM type of records. It was a period of time where FM was growing and beginning to overtake AM. I was simulcast on both AM and FM, and at night, people could hear the AM station, and I don't know how many states the engineers could probably tell me. Probably I used to count about 14 states that would call me at night, plus Ontario, plus Quebec, plus Newfoundland, and all the Maritimes in Canada. And the only place that they could hear the music that I was playing on AM was the WDRC at night. And they would call me up and make requests. And I was doing this revolutionary thing on that radio station. It seemed to work, I guess. But I have no idea why Charlie ever let me do it at all. And it worked very well. And then I was offered the job by and by as the program director at WPLR in New Haven. Got the chance then to be asleep at night and work in the afternoon there. We made that into a very successful radio station. Then one other thing, and then I want Steve to tell me why Charlie let me do it, because he remembers that whole era, certainly. Walt Dibble was the news director. Walt Dibble's son was Rob Dibble, the Major League Baseball pitcher, and Walt was a really good guy. And he came to me one day and he said, you know, there's going to be a new hockey team here in the area. Would you be interested in covering it for the radio station? I'd never been to a hockey game, but I went. And the first year they played, as Arnold Dean knows, at the Big E Arena in West Springfield. So I'd drive up there to every game. I'd try to sit with players that were injured and ask a lot of stupid questions. The old reporters, you know, would look at me like I was an idiot because I had long hair and the beard was much longer. And these guys were the writers from the newspapers. And I learned, and I got better at doing that. Then I got to do the Celtics and the Red Sox and the Bruins. And then when I left the Hartford and New Haven area, I moved to Pittsburgh, and I got to do the Steelers and the Penguins and the Pirates. And I went to Wisconsin, and I did the Milwaukee Bucks and Milwaukee Brewers, etc. Then to New York, where I did many, many years with the New York Islanders, and actually had a sports TV show and did the Islanders post-game show on their radio network for quite a few years. So that all came from Charlie giving me a break, and that's how it all started for me, and I ended up having a very good career. But I still want to know why he let me do that.
One picture from one Christmas party. No.
That's not a drinking
No, the right pictures from the right parties, you can pretty much name your price. No. Actually, my dad really was a program director who believed in directing people. He saw what Barry's talent was, as he did with everyone else who was on the air, and he directed their talent. He could see their talent, and he could help them develop their talent until their talent grew so large that it would move on to bigger and better stations in many cases. And he was always happy to see them go on, because they did. He directed them. He said, okay, there you go, and he'd shake their hand and say, the best of luck. So he had a good gut feeling about you. I mean, we met you when I was looking at a car in Manchester. I think Rod Allen's house, wasn't it? Yeah, it was one of those nights. But and Barry kind of downplays it, but Barry was in the very beginning, especially with album-oriented rock stations. I think you were FM Program Director of the Year for AOR stations, weren't you?
Three times.
This man knew by first name basis most of the top rock and roll acts when we were kids growing up. Back when we were in our teen years, Barry knew them all intimately and spoke to them all on a regular basis, and they had a lot of respect for him. So as much as we're paying tribute to the golden years, it's hard to believe that this is part of the golden era, but anyways, I really want you to understand that I did want to point out that Barry tonight, it's great to have him here because he was on the cutting edge, and really his career took off from there, but it started right here in Hartford. So I just wanted to thank you very, very much.
Thank you. And one other comment for me is, at the time, FM finally did overtake AM. Too bad, AM, and FM, except for WTIC AM, FM became the bigger deal of the two, and now I think probably most people here, I don't know, Bill, what do you think? Think they're FM listeners? JMJ seems to
have
a big fan club here. Yeah, doing very well. So it was a very exciting time to be in radio and be all part of that.
Thanks, Barry Grant's tune, Elite. Lee Gordon, if you could...
You got to come out up here so we can be on camera.
Yeah, Lee, come on up, because Lee's got quite a history with WPOP, and those of you who grew up listening to the POP good guys, this was one of them right here.
So, and you can see Lee every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 2 o'clock on Channel 61.
I'm only on a Friday on
camera. No, doing the midday drawings for the Connecticut Lottery.
What does he draw?
I love the ping pong balls that I'll be weighing tomorrow. When I arrived at WPOP from the woods of New Hampshire, I came in 1974. Bob Greske was the general manager, and by the time I got to POP, cart number six was the Arthur's jingle. But by the time I got there, the jingle was Arthur's open almost all the time. That was the jingle. I never knew that Arthur's was open all the time. And I participated in the ultimate demise of AM radio. And I was at BOP from February 74 till June of 75, when the format was changed to all news, and I was out of work because they didn't need disc jockeys for an all-news station. So I asked them if maybe they would consider hiring me to be the production director. But they figured, the first disc jockey job that comes along, he'll get it out of here. So they said, no thanks. 3 years later, when I was still in town, they said, well, maybe this guy isn't leaving, and the job opened up, and I went back to POP in 78 and became a production director until 1997. So that's in modern terms, that's a relatively long stretch in the same job in a radio station.
Tell us what Charlie did for you.
Actually, Charlie, in addition to being a great program director, had a great voice, which unfortunately, due to some medical mishap, shall we say, he lost his voice. And Charlie was the regular announcer for several clients, and when Charlie was no longer able to record the commercials himself, he lined me up to be basically his replacement for a couple of his long-term clients, and I really appreciate that. And the funny thing is that Charlie could have hired me when I was let go of from my disc jockey job at POP, but my former general manager in New Hampshire was good friends with Dick Corson, the general manager at DRC, and when he heard the rumors that POP was changing formats, he placed a call in my behalf to see about lining me up a gig at DRC, and he called me to tell me that now Corson hates you. So Charlie never had the chance to hire me, even if he wanted to. So that's my brief history with being on the radio in Hartford.
And before we turn it back to Steve for the final comments, if you go to WDRC, even to this day, they're out on Blue Hills Avenue, right in the corner of Cottage Grove Road, which is just down the street from Capaco, the supermarket shopping center on Cottage Grove Road.
You're the
Capaco manager. I was the Capaco reporter for 150 years. Matter of fact, Herman Berkowitz just died, and his funeral was last Friday. But Capaco was a big deal, but it was in the backyard of DRC, which was really in a cow field. But to this day, unless I'm mistaken, there's a sign when you go into the DRC production facilities. It says WWCD. And you might think that's the call letters for another station. It stands for What Would Charlie Do? And that's how important he was to this area.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you, everybody. Yeah, I kind of came from broadcast stock. I grew up in the business. My mom, Ann, they called her Pat Parker, worked at WDRC before my dad. They met there in World War II, fell in love, and my sister Kathy and I were born. And I found out just a few years ago that my mom, not only was she the receptionist, but she also co-hosted an afternoon show on WDRC. So it's literally in my blood, and it's just been so great to be with all of you guys here tonight. But one thing that always baffles some people that remember the old days of the WPOP good guys, and you know, fun is WDRC. When my dad retired because of his health in 1983, and I stayed a little while at DRC while he wasn't there, and literally the life had been sucked out of the radio station. The fun was gone, the laughter every day was gone, and I said, you know, I really want to stay in the business, but I really don't want to be here. And it was a real tough decision. I said to my dad, you know, Dad, I really want to stay in Hartford Radio. Where would you recommend? He goes, WPOP, great guys. Al Pellegrino is one of the best broadcasters there is. So that's how I made the transition to WPOP, was with my dad's blessing. So I was very fortunate to spend time with Al Pellegrino and a great staff, Lee Gordon, a lot of other guys. And I got to do a lot of neat things in the business. But I really want to thank all of you so much tonight. It's been so much fun reliving a lot of these memories. And you guys, you're just living, breathing treasures. I mean, just so wonderful. Let's hear it for all the guys who got up tonight, the golden years of broadcasting.
Let's stand up here.
Is that Charlie?
Yeah, that's Charlie.
Yeah. We have a question. Frank just doesn't want to get out. I mean, go ahead, Frank.
Just for the historical record, as long as it's being taped,
You're standing in front of the camera, so they have that back of your head. Go ahead. What's...
Well, as my mother used to say, Frankie, I know you're a pain, but I cannot see through you.
You don't get that.
Why doesn't somebody just take a couple of moments to talk about the early days, the birth of ESPN? Anyone?
The birth of ESPN. That'd be you. Well, I remember Dave Overson couldn't be here tonight, but he was part of that birth.
Dave was at ESPN for most of its career. We had a TIC engineer, Steve Myers, who was very instrumental in getting it off the ground. A guy named Bill Rasmussen used to do the Springfield Indians hockey games up in Springfield. He was a play-by-play announcer. And he applied for something that nobody paid any attention to called a satellite transmission device. But he could just apply for the license and get it. Nobody was fighting for it. And the way he described it once, I saw him speak at a function. He was marching down the street, and a parade formed behind him. But he was the first one to get the license to put on this new thing called satellite television. And they had done all of the engineering studies to find out that the best place for it was on Market Street in Bristol. Of all places.
Middle Street.
It's still there, only it's now the largest employer in the city of Bristol, long ago overtaking General Motors. They have like 4,000 employees, even though they've had a recent layoff. And as you know, the rest is what they say history. The thing is in four or five different languages. It's 24/7. The phenomenal facilities. They have an awful lot of interns, which is another term for slave labor.
You gotta love them.
Yeah, go to college and are willing to do anything to get into the business. And that's real. And a guy that used to be a POP, Chris Vernon. He was a sports announcer at WPOP in the early days. Am I right, Lee?
No, you're not.
Channel 30. Okay, Channel 30? Okay, Charlie Steiner was at POP.
Charlie Steiner, right?
Yeah. And
Chris Berman was doing the Saturday Night Sports
on Channel 30
for about $15 a show, and looking for something better for some reason.
hang on 1 second. We got to have that for the record, just so we hear that. Arnoldine.
Chris Berman was working at Channel 30, whatever their WNBC. What is it? Channel 30.
Well, HNBC.
Whatever it is. Yeah. With their beautiful new studios, by the way. But he was working there. He was paid about $25 a week. Before that, he was doing the sports talk show, which was the first one in the state to compete with my sports show. And he now loves to talk about the fact that all he did was try to scratch about 2 listeners out of every 100 because our show was so well established and popular at that point. And he used to call me frequently and say, what am I going to do for a living, you know? But I directed it pretty well, didn't I? But just to get back to how things went, before Chris Berman was hired there, although he is one of the veterans, Lou Palmer and I did most of their play-by-play. Lou Palmer shortly thereafter left TIC and worked with them for a while.
And it goes to show that anybody can get into broadcasting. All that Chris Berman did was graduate from Brown University. And we had a fellow at Channel 3 named Dick Huntley, who's an active member of the Boobs, too, who, when I first met him, he had just gotten out of Brown, or he was after the war, at least, and this was 1957 when Channel 3 signed on. I used to be amazed that we could draw people with that educational background into our crazy business. And I would always say to him, what is a nice guy like you doing in a business like this? And that was true of Chris Berman as well.
All right, how about a round of applause for everybody tonight? Hopefully we got a round of applause for everybody. But before, just one more thing about before we adjourn, I would like to bring Al Cohn out one more time because I gotta tell you, he is a pioneer broadcaster in this area, and he was so committed to making this happen tonight. And he called me up and he said, you know, I got Bill Hennessy. What do you think? And I said, well, you know, we're talking about a summer night. We're talking about the end of summer. I don't know. And he said to me, Bill thinks it's going to be good. I said, okay, well, if Bill thinks it's going to be good, then I felt good. And I want to thank all of you for coming up. But first, I want to bring Al out here because Al is a great broadcaster himself, and we owe a lot of stuff to Al, everything he does up here. Al Cohn.
Thank you.
for those kind words. And I'm overwhelmed. Really, this turned out much better than I had planned. Matter of fact, I didn't plan. But I want to tell one brief little story relating to my career in broadcasting, which ended many, many years ago, over half a century ago. But at one time, my assignment was to pick up the big bands that played at the State Theater on Friday nights. I used to do the setup, set the microphones up, and so forth, and I had the pleasure of doing all the big bands. Kay Kaiser, Benny Goodman, Sammy Kay, name them all. I had the pleasure of meeting all those guys. And one night, Sammy Kay was playing at the State Theater in Hartford. And I was a young single fellow then, chummed around with a bunch of other single guys, and said to one of my friends, "Hey, how would you like to see the show backstage tonight?" And he said, "Yeah, I'd love it." I said, "All right, but you're going to look for remote cases, you're going to look microphone cables and so forth." He said, "That's fine, I'll go." So after the show was over, I rolled up all the cables, we packed up the suitcases, and at the stage door, as we were going out, was this mob of Bobby Suckers, high school girls that just adored Sammy Kay. And as I came out the door carrying two remote cases, I turned around and said to my friend, "Okay, Sammy, right this way." And oh, but I do want to thank, I want to say this, that this is being taped by Channel 14 by two volunteers, Tim Linesbury and his son Tim Linesbury Jr., under the supervision of Ed Pizzello, who's sitting there taking it all in. And these guys do it as a labor of love. So let's get it. And the way this came about, Bill Hennessy was a kind of hesitant. He said, "Well, what do you want me to say? And what are we? I don't know really what I'm going to talk about." And so don't worry, you get up there with a microphone in your hand and work out. And we didn't really discuss the matter of salary, but if he comes back again, we'll double his salary.
Al, can we get copies of this? Can we get copies?
Come again?
Can we get copies?
Well, it depends what the price is.
Anyway, I can't thank Bill enough for tonight's performance. I want to also thank the Paradise Restaurant for being so good to us. Let us have this place as we do once a month. And Paradise puts out good food at affordable prices. I'm going to give it back. They're good people. And I give it back to Steve.
Thank you. Al Cohen, let's hear it for him. I'm sure the question will come up is, are there copies available of this program? You have to contact New Inc. Community Television, NCTV 14, or call Ed Pizzella's office in New Inc., and he might be able to give you a little direction with that. And that's only if it's actually on tape. We'll have to take a look at it after we're all done here. It's a wonderful world of television, you know, it's unexpected. But I'm sure that I would be more than happy if you're interested to do this, and if any of the viewers want it, just contact NCTV 14. That's one of the places I work. All right, Bob, I think we can hand it back to you. Thanks, everybody.
Before we close, I have one more Charlie Parker story to tell. Because I was Charlie Parker's neighbor when Stevie was too young to be Stevie. It was before Stevie talked. The best day of the year to go to Charlie Parker's house was Halloween. Right, Steve? Charlie put on a show. Kids came from miles around to be scared to death. He dressed himself up in a monster outfit. And he had all kinds of eerie music playing. But my brother and I pulled one over on Charlie Parker when we were kids. Charlie had I don't know if Steven even remembers. One of his little promos was the secret sound.
Oh, yeah.
And you won an 8-transistor radio.
Oh, that was early, because we had jackpots after that.
But anyway, my younger brother, who was blind, had very acute hearing. And because of that, he was interested in all kinds of sounds. He was the smarter of the two of us. He ended up with 2 master's degrees and everything. But he had this thing for radio and sounds. So he had this collection of sounds. They were just LP records that had all of these sounds on it. Well, he had the same radio. I mean, the same record that Charlie used to make these sounds. Well, I want to tell you, you could only win one radio, but every member of my family, every cousin, had a radio at DRC. And years later, when I met Charlie and he found out, I had to jump over the fence to get away from him. That's hysterical.
That's probably what led him to actually go out and start recording this stuff out of the road and out of the yard, because you had that album.
But anyway, Kiwanis thanks you all very much. Thank you for bringing us all down memory lane. I heard names that I haven't heard in years. I used to sled in Goodwin Park with Bob Steele's son. But to hear all of these names again bring back a lot of great memories. And Kiwanis thanks you. Good night, everybody.
You mentioned Bob Steele, and a little bit of housekeeping here, because you did mention Bob. A fellow by the name of Christopher Fortier told me that there's a Bob Steele fan page on Facebook. All right, so for those of you that are into Facebook, and actually Chris is trying to have something in Hartford named after Bob. Maybe Arnold's got some ideas about what we should name after Bob Steele. But he's actually looking for people that can give him some information. He has an email, cmfortier@gmail.com. But probably the easiest thing to do is just go to, or if you don't, have someone in your family go to Facebook and check out the Bob Steele fan page on Facebook. All right? Thank you, Bob, and thank you, Bob. All right.